Thank you very much, Michael. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming to my lecture. Moving is, of course, good, Michael, as long as you don't do it again too quickly. Okay, it is a big title. There are quite a lot of issues here. I'm going to try and connect the different ideas here. I'm going to, in this lecture, draw a little bit on things that I have done, but I'd also like to talk a little bit about things that I wish to do or plan to do over the next couple of years. Okay, so let's just start with some basic ideas and the idea about economic growth. Now, a lot of this information will be familiar to many of you, so we can hopefully go through this relatively quickly. Economic growth is clearly very important for poverty reduction. That's self-evidently the case. The big successes in poverty reduction, China, India, Vietnam, have been countries that have grown fast and translated that growth into poverty reduction. It's self-evident that economic growth usually, but not always, is good for poverty reduction. Now let's just look at some historical evidence on the economic growth. And that chart shows the growth performance of different regions of the world. And what I'd ask you to focus on is not the top line there, Latin America, but rather the dark blue one here. And what you see in that case, which is East Asia, is a dramatic and consistent increase in income over that 50-year period. And basically, if we compare incomes in 1960 with incomes in 2008, it's a factor of 12 and a half. This is dramatic growth. The world as a whole, incomes grew by about 2.5% a year over this decade. In East Asia, they grew by nearly five times as much. The dramatic contrast with that is sub-Saharan Africa, where incomes increased by only about 40% over the entire 50 years. And incomes were not that much higher 50 years later than they were in 1960. Dramatic variation in growth performance. East Asia, the stellar performer. South Asia also performing quite well. Sub-Saharan Africa performing very indifferently. And the point about East Asian growth is it's been consistent. That shows growth rates over decades. Well, in each decade from the 1970s onwards, growth in East Asia was really fast, was really high. In South Asia, decent growth performance from the 1980s onwards. Look at Latin America, look at Africa, and you see decades, two decades in Africa, of negative growth. So consistent, positive, impressive performance in Asia, especially East Asia. And the point about that is, it translates very much into the story in terms of poverty reduction. That table shows some numbers comparing poverty at the beginning of the 1980s with 2005. And again, the emphatic story is Asia, poverty nearly 80% in 1981, less than 30 years ago, down to 18% in 2005, reduced to a quarter of what it was. Poverty in South Asia fell by about a third over the period. Poverty in sub-Saharan Africa was pretty much the same 25 years later as it was in 1981. Strongly associated, of course, with the growth performance. You can see the dramatic poverty reduction here and quite good performance in South Asia. So, dramatic variations in growth performance, dramatic variations in poverty reduction. Now, I'm not going to talk about in detail about the factors underlying East Asian success. That could be a whole series of lectures in its own right. But two factors that are very important were the development of manufacturing, impressive development, upgrading of manufacturing, and very active trade. Manufacturing. Hong Kong, when I was at primary school, the manufacturing, the quality of products manufactured from Hong Kong at that time was very poor quality. By the time I was a teenager, the quality of manufacturers from Hong Kong had dramatically improved, had dramatically upgraded. And that's a consistent story throughout the East Asian region. Dramatic development of manufacturing, improvement of quality, and an important underlying factor was the extent of trade between countries in the region and often trade within the same industrial sectors, what we call intra-industry trade. Dramatic growth in trade, openness to trade, impressive trade performance, rapid development of manufacturing. Contrast that with the slower growing regions we just saw, and the manufacturing performance is much weaker in Latin America, in sub-Saharan Africa. The trade performance is much weaker. They were much more protective in their trade. The factor endowments are also different. These are much less labor-intensive regions of the world compared to Asia. But they didn't trade very much. Manufacturing developed much less. Now, as the title suggested, that's not fundamentally what I want to focus on. What I'd like to do is talk about two things, as well as the extent of the Asian experience is translatable: the role of urbanization and the spatial inequality that Michael spoke about. Now, quickly on urbanization, just by way of introduction. Asia is actually not that high in terms of the degree of urbanization. If we look at the percentage of the population living in urban areas in Asia, it's lower than the world average, although it increases consistently over the period. But it increases everywhere. It increases in South Asia. That urbanization was an important story, an important part of the development of the manufacturing sector, no doubt. But we see that urbanization in sub-Saharan Africa as well. Without the manufacturing growth, without the impressive poverty reduction. And we see a very high level of urbanization in Latin America, but again, much more indifferent performance in manufacturing and poverty reduction. So, is urbanization unambiguously a good thing for poverty reduction? The second of the two concepts that I'm adding is spatial inequality. Now that, in the sense of inequality within a country between different regions. So some areas of a country may have relatively high income compared to other areas of a country. We know this in Europe. We know it in terms of, say, north-south divides in the UK, the north-south division in Italy, in Northern Ireland, the divide between the east and the west of the province. These things are important spatial inequalities. There was a major project by the World Institute for Development Economics Research in Helsinki in the early years of the 2000s, looking at spatial inequality and highlighting both very high levels of spatial inequality and increasing spatial inequality over time. And those increases in spatial inequality happening at the same time as countries moved towards being more open. So, is spatial inequality a price of growth? Does it go with growth? That example from China, the blue line there is about the extent of openness of the economy. From 1950 up to 2005, dramatic increases in the openness of China over this period, especially over the last 25 years. The black line is the inequality between the inland provinces of China and the coast. And we know that a lot of the growth and development has happened in coastal areas. As that black line goes up, it signifies that coastal regions are falling increasingly far behind. Sorry, inland regions are falling increasingly far behind coastal regions. And look at how dramatically closely associated those two things are. This example from Vietnam shows the proportion of inequality, which is due to inequality between regions of the country, between provinces of the country. How much of the overall inequality is due to the fact that one province or one region is much richer than another. And what we see over this period is a significant increase in these numbers. The importance of inequality between regions increases sharply over time. Same example from Ghana, the tile index is a measure of inequality. It increases over time. The share of inequality between regions of Ghana or between the north and the south of Ghana increases sharply over the 1990s. In all of these cases, these happen in a context of growth. So is spatial inequality a price of growth? In terms of questions, whether Asian success is translatable to other regions, whether spatial inequality is a necessary price of growth, and whether urbanization is beneficial for growth and poverty reduction. So let's start with the first question. The World Development Report of the World Bank, published in 2009, took for its theme reshaping economic geography. And this is about the spatial distribution of production and population within countries and how that is or is not associated with growth performance. And in that report, they assert that economic transformation of countries is associated with those three things: greater density, production, population being more concentrated spatially is good for economic transformation. Shorter distances, it's easier for people, for workers to move from one place to another. And fewer divisions, thinner borders, it's easier for countries to trade with each other. Concentrating production is going to be beneficial for growth, but it's also going to give us spatially unbalanced growth because some areas will grow fast and others will be left behind. And there are lots of reasons why that concentration of production may be important. Having lots of firms together in the same city or in the same location, they benefit from being beside each other. So they may be in the same industry, they may be hiring a similar pool of workers, they may be requiring similar input suppliers, all of which can be in that urban location. There can be significant benefits to being in an urban location because one gets lots of facilities, lots of benefits, all in the same place. There can be significant benefits from concentration of production. And when transport costs fall, and when we don't have significant trade barriers, concentration is what you're likely to get. It encourages the process of specialization. A process of specialization encourages firms in manufacturing to become more efficient. As firms start to trade more, transport costs may fall more, and it's a virtuous circle. It's not, of course, a virtuous circle for the regions that are left behind. But this, it's argued in the World Development Report, is an important part of what generates growth. And if we try to have a distributionally equal, a regionally equal pattern of growth, it's going to be a slower growth. We're choking off the very process that causes growth. Living standards then may diverge before they converge. And they talk about different policy responses which can help to tackle or minimize this effect, including a broad-based provision of social services. The intellectual justification for that is based on an economic literature of new economic geography. And the idea about new economic geography, it asks questions about where economic activity takes place. So why does economic activity happen in one location as opposed to another? And we can identify both what we call first nature and second nature advantages. First nature advantages are simply things about natural advantages that a location has. It's near to the coast, so that's good for exporting, it's good for importing, it's good for trade. That's where the mineral deposits happen to be. So that's where the activity takes place. That's where the land is more fertile. And that would encourage concentration of production in those locations. But there's a second nature set of arguments as well, which is, if production is concentrated in a particular location, that very fact attracts more people to that location because they benefit from other producers being in the same location. The benefits of a concentrated urbanization, a concentration of production in a Silicon Valley type effect, many producers altogether. And the point is that those second nature effects may be very important. We can identify factors which encourage concentration and factors which discourage concentration. But where production is characterized by economies of scale, by producing more, you produce more efficiently, and where transport costs are low, that's going to encourage this process of concentration. And typically what one gets in these type of models is a sort of core-periphery type story. You get well-developed core areas of the country where lots of production takes place, where income levels are quite high, and peripheral areas of the country with much lower levels of production, lower income levels. Geographical agglomeration is often good for growth as well. So it benefits growth as well, not just level of income, but also growth. And that factor can be beneficial not just for the core region, but it can even benefit the periphery as well. Yes, the periphery remains poorer, but the periphery may be better off because the core region of the economy is growing faster. Now, I would say that the World Development Report, the New Economic Geography, is not a bad story in terms of some of the Asian success stories. The manufacturing, active trade policy, low transport costs, labor-intensive sectors, that's a good story in Asia. But question the applicability in the other regions of the world. Let's just ask a couple of questions about the applicability to Latin America and Sub-Saharan Africa. Now, the first point about these regions is that you have much less manufacturing sector, much less well-developed manufacturing sector, and frankly, without good prospects. China and other Asian countries have so much cornered the market in manufacturing that there are niche opportunities maybe for Africa and Latin America, but China is such a dominant player. Now, urbanization, we can link to that idea of concentration, but urbanization doesn't really explain that story, because Africa is less urbanized, but Latin America is more urbanized. But the point about urbanization in both of those locations is that large numbers of people work not in manufacturing sectors, not in formal economic activities, but rather in informal, small-scale activities. And those small-scale activities, well, they maybe do not have those benefits of concentration, of production. What we need, I think, is new economic geography models which include the informal sector. And we don't tend to have those. And what would we want to know about the informal sector? Well, first of all, what is the growth potential in that sector? A lot of the advantages that the formal sector, that the manufacturing sector has, the informal sector maybe doesn't have. It's small scale, it's typically lower skilled workers, etc. We need to know about the extent to which the informal sector links to the formal sector. We need to know about the extent of mobility of firms and workers from the informal sector into the formal sector. And those are things I think we still don't know about. And we also need to know, of course, what factors affect migration. Now, on the spatial inequality idea, is that necessarily associated with growth? Well, we need to be concerned about spatial inequality between regions of a country, because these can often align with political and ethnic tensions within countries. Indigenous populations in Latin America, populations in the coastal regions in West Africa compared to the north, etc. These are important sources of tension. Spatial inequality could make conflict more likely. And is urbanization unambiguously a good thing? What I'd like to do is look at some evidence from three countries in relation to these questions: Ghana, Peru, and Vietnam. One from each country. Ghana, basically, it's the first country I ever worked in. I've worked in on and off in Ghana for nearly 25 years. Vietnam, I've worked on a bit in the last 6 or 7 years. Peru is basically a country I've just started working on. Now, let me say something about spatial inequality, and then let me say something about urbanization. In relation to spatial inequality, we've said already this is a familiar story as well in European contexts. If we look at some data there from Peru, this GE is a sort of inequality index, and we also have the Gini coefficient there, which measures inequality. What one sees there is, for most of those inequality indices, increases in inequality between 2000 and 2008. For most of those measures of inequality, inequality between 8 regions of Peru also increases over time. Spatial inequality in Peru maybe also increases over the 2000s. But spatial inequality is not something that people haven't been aware of. It's not something that countries haven't been concerned about. It's been a major issue, including in Asia. China has a long history of development programs for poor areas. Vietnam has developed policies specifically targeting ethnic minorities and disadvantaged regions. Malaysia had policies in the 1970s about equalizing ethnic inequalities in the country. Ghana has policies of educational scholarship favoring people from northern locations compared to those in the south. People have been concerned about spatial inequality and have actively taken steps to address it. Well, let me say a little bit more about evidence and spatial inequality, because the story is not as simple as I just presented it at the beginning of the lecture. There's some data from Vietnam, the generalized entropy index again of inequality. What that data shows, first, is that inequality fell between 2002 and 2006. And secondly, the share of inequality between regions also fell. Spatial inequality fell. Overall inequality fell. Spatial inequality fell. It doesn't consistently always increase. We saw those big increases in Vietnam in the 1990s. It doesn't continue. Updating the table I had before by adding the two more most recent years, the contribution of inequality between regions, between provinces, falls. Spatial inequality is not monotonically increasing. Ghana, same story. Inequality continues to increase, but the share of between-region inequality, the share of inequality between the north and the south, which increased so much in the 1990s, falls. So either... Now, of course, these are only particular observations, so we can't necessarily generalize just from data on 1 year, but it does seem to suggest that spatial inequality can fall as well as rise. The story in Ghana is a story about infrastructure. They invested a lot over the 1990s in building roads, connecting the south and the north of the country. the regions of the north of Ghana, which were well connected by the new roads, those are the ones that converge. The one region in the north of Ghana, which was not well connected, that's the one that diverged. So infrastructure seems to be very important in shaping spatial inequality. Spatial inequality doesn't have to increase. A review that I did with Emily Parrish, looking at 15 countries in Africa, doesn't suggest consistent increases in spatial inequality in Africa. Yes, it increases in some, but it decreases in others. And it isn't associated with whether they're growing faster or not. So maybe spatial inequality doesn't necessarily increase. We should be concerned about increases in spatial inequality. Increases in spatial inequality may not be inevitable, and various things like encouraging migration to where there are job opportunities or infrastructure can actually prevent an increase in spatial inequality. So let me finish by saying something about urbanization. Now, this is the part of the lecture on which I've worked least. And this is about work that I'm proposing to develop. And Richard Dickens and I developed a research proposal on this and are planning to work on this issue over the next year or two. In 2007, half the world's population became urban. That was a significant event. Overman and Venables argue that over the next 30 years, we may have another 2 billion urban residents. And if one looks at the story of urbanization and how it relates to poverty, urbanization seems to be associated with reductions in poverty. There's been significant urbanization, there's been significant reductions of poverty, and they're associated with each other. Except the story differs a bit by region. Again, Asia, urban poverty is low, and the growth of cities has definitely helped to reduce poverty. But in Latin America, urban poverty remains very high. In sub-Saharan Africa, there's been rapid urbanization. It's now, I think, the fastest urbanizing region of the world. But poverty hasn't fallen much. And it's as if we've shifted poverty from rural areas into urban areas. So urbanization may not be having beneficial impacts on poverty reduction there. Now, there's lots of arguments about the importance of urbanization in growth and poverty reduction, and new economic geography is just one of those. There are lots of arguments for the benefits. But there's also lots of costs. One third of the urban population is now meant to be living in slums. And that is an important and significant finding. Now, of course, some of you may have seen the TV programs last week on this, and it's an open question how much dynamism and activity. It's certainly not self-evident that there's not a lot of dynamism and activity even in slum locations. But one third of the urban population living in slums. Another issue is limited job opportunities. Now, this again is a contrast between Asia and the success stories in Asia, rather, not all of Asia. The success stories of Asia and Africa and Latin America. The successful countries in Asia have done well in terms of creating jobs, in employment creation. Latin America and Africa have been much weaker. So there are limited job opportunities. And of course, there's negative externalities. People, by being in urban areas, impose costs on other people in urban areas. They create more demand on services. They create congestion. They impose costs. They make things more expensive for other people and so on. And the lack of public services, which is increasingly an issue, especially in slum locations, can exacerbate poverty. Now, a lot of what we know about urbanization in relation to poverty and growth is typically based on cross-country studies or is very context or locality specific. What I'm going to say something about is looking at these three countries and seeing if we can say anything about urbanization and linked to poverty. So, three questions that we might ask. Let's think about migrants, people that have recently arrived to urban areas. Urbanization, of course, is fueled by a process of migration. So let's ask questions about the people that are migrants to urban areas. And let's ask about welfare. Let's ask about what work they do. Let's ask about the conditions, the housing conditions in which they live. And tentatively, as a starting point, one might think they're probably more likely to work in the informal sector, they're probably more likely to be poor, though they might get less poor over time, and they're likely to be living in poor quality housing and have less good access to public services. So what I'm going to do, or the evidence I'll talk about in the last 5 minutes of the lecture, is just based on some surveys. Surveys are not necessarily the ideal source here. Surveys may or may not cover slum locations comprehensively. It depends a lot on the design of the sample. Typically, slum locations would be underrepresented in surveys. And also, for the work for this lecture, we don't always have explicit identification of what are the slum locations and what are not. In relation to migrants, in the case of Ghana, we can confidently identify migrants. In the case of Peru and Vietnam, it's a little bit more difficult. So what about the informal sector? Well, that shows a dramatic difference in the importance of the informal sector in Vietnam relative to Peru and Ghana. Those working in the informal sector are almost always poorer than the average. So a lot of people working in the informal sector, typically poorer than average. So are these the migrants? Well, let's look at Ghana. Ghana, we know when people migrated, we know how long ago they migrated, so we can study that. Now, what this table shows is the share of people in the national quintile of distribution. The first national quintile, the top national quintile. The bottom national quintile is 20% of the population. The top national quintile is also 20% of the population. But this is just the urban population. So 6.7% of the population, of the urban population of Ghana is in the bottom quintile. 40% is in the top quintile. Okay. But the non-migrants, more of them are actually in the bottom quintile, fewer of them are in the top quintile. Migrants, on average, may be slightly better off. But not these ones. Not the ones that have migrated from rural areas to urban areas. The rural to urban migrants, more of them are in the bottom quintile, fewer of them are in the top quintile. So it depends on the type of migration that we're talking about. But migrants don't seem to be worse off. And we can look at whether people migrated recently or migrated a long time ago. It doesn't really affect the story. Migrants are actually more likely to work not in the informal sector, but in the formal sector, except the rural to urban migrants. But the migrants do live in poorer quality dwellings. The housing in which they live is significantly poorer, even if they're more likely to have formal sector jobs. In Peru, we can't precisely define migration, but we know how many members in the household were born outside the location where they're currently living. Defining migrants in that way, which is not ideal, households that have more migrants tend to be less poor, tend to be more likely to work in the formal sector, but again are worse off in terms of housing conditions. They're more likely to occupy the property that they have by invasion rather than having, and they're less likely to have clear property rights to their houses. In Vietnam, it's harder to identify migrants, but to the extent that we do, those that are migrants, typically, they don't have worse jobs compared to other urban residents. Again, they seem to do relatively well in terms of getting formal sector jobs. Now, very preliminary results, very tentative, but migrants are not necessarily worse off. Of course, there's a huge variation in experience of migrants. Some are worse off. We can look at panel data as well, where we follow the same house, the same individuals over time, and see how they change over time. If we look at Peru, what we see, comparing just 2004 and 2006, many more people over this period move into work than move out of work. Many more people move from informal activities into formal activities than the other way around. So there seems to be a dynamic going on where people are more likely to work in formal sector jobs over time. That's extremely tentative, that's extremely preliminary results in urbanization, and it's a sort of starting point for what I'd like to do in future. It isn't, of course, the ideal data. We need to spend a lot more time in country. We need to collect specific data, in particular in slum locations, in order to assess this properly. But there's some evidence that migrants might be better off, might be more likely to have better jobs compared to non-migrants on average. But they have worse housing, they have less good access to services, and that's also important. And those factors might stop the ones that are, say, in the informal sector. We've got evidence of upward labor market mobility in Peru, and that's important. In terms of summarizing the themes of the lecture, we basically have three. About the extent to which Asian success translates, about urbanization, about spatial inequality. The new economic geography story, I think, fits well to Asia. But it's much more difficult to fit to Latin America or to Africa. So if these areas are not developing manufacturing, are there other areas where they can benefit from these sort of scale economies, from these sort of agglomeration effects? Are there possibilities in the informal sector? Are there possibilities for gradual formalization in the informal sector? We need a new economic geography, a development of the new economic geography literature, I think, to look at some of these types of issues. The second point, I think, is that spatial inequality is by no means an inevitable price of growth. We should be concerned about it. We should be worried about it. It isn't an inevitable price of growth. And secondly, and finally, urbanization actually may not be such a bad thing for growth or poverty reduction, even in Africa and Latin America. So there is some evidence of people moving to urban areas, perhaps becoming better off. But there's a huge variation of experience. And for many people, they don't get better off. And that's something we need to understand. Thank you very much.